Welcome to the Lavo Show podcast. Conversations with outstanding human beings whose love has been inspired and transformed by Osho. Take a deep breath and enjoy the show.
Enjoy the show.
Hello and thanks for tuning in. My name is Swaram and I'm the host. Today our guest is Swami Deva Mutribo. Mutribo took sannyas in 1978 and was the main videographer during Osho's time. Much of the footage available in the docu-series Wild Wild Country was recorded by Mutribo. I'm so happy to have Mutribo on the show and I hope you enjoy it. Mutribo, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm very well, sir, and thank you for having me on.
It's absolutely my pleasure. To start, tell us a little bit about how you came across Osho.
Okay, you have to go back to London in the mid-70s. I had just returned from living in New York for a couple of years where I was working in filmmaking. And a girlfriend of mine came back from San Francisco area with a book by a man I'd never heard of, Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, which was called Tantra, Spirituality and Sex. And she said, look, I think you may like this, so why don't you read it? So I did. And it was a very powerful experience for me in many ways. Firstly, my studies at university had been in French and European literature, and I'd really been in love with literature for a long time. But for many years, I really had not found any book or reading material that inspired me. And I started to read this book by Osho and was immediately absorbed and taken by it, to the extent that at a certain point during the reading of the book, Osho shed light on the whole concept of enlightenment, which essentially I didn't really know anything about. For me, there had been Jesus as an example of someone in an elevated spiritual state, and that was it. I really hadn't come across any of the enlightened masters that other people at that time were either following or had heard of. And so basically Osho introduced me to this idea that enlightenment, this phenomenon of enlightenment, had been going on for thousands of years and was still going on and had never been a break, and that he himself was in that space. And I had thought when I was a young boy and I was, you know, doing divinity classes at school, I'd often wondered why there had been people during Jesus's lifetime who hadn't been able to recognize the quality of his consciousness and, in fact, had ended up crucifying. And somehow inside myself, I had always pictured that I would have been able to understand the space that he was in and the vision that he was sharing. And suddenly, here I am on a London bus reading this book, and I realize that there is a man now alive, living in India, who is essentially in the same space. And so I immediately was concerned as to whether actually he was still in the body. So I did a little bit of research and then quickly made my plans to go to India and see him, because I was afraid that he might die before I got there. So that was essentially how I ended up going to Pune in 1978 and taking sannyas.
So in 1978, you arrived in Pune and you met Osho. And what happened then? Have you been with Osho since then, or you were one of those guys who had to, you know, go back, make some money and travel up and down, or you were one of the permanent residents in the commune?
Yeah, no, basically I went, my first visit was for 2 months, and I had pretty much decided before I got there that I wanted to, that point in my life, training to be a therapist in London, and I had decided that I wanted to do some of the therapies that were available in the ashram at that time, partly because they had become so notorious for the intensity that they had, and I felt like it would be a a great next step for me to dive into that. And on top of that, I had always been interested in the idea of a commune or living with like-minded people. So there were basically three essential attractions that got me to Pune. One was Osho and his vision and understanding that here was a man in this space called enlightenment. Secondly was the fact that I was training to be a therapist, and all of the therapeutic techniques that were going on in Pune at that time were really cutting edge, and I definitely wanted to immerse myself in that. And thirdly, I'd longed for a long time to be living on a daily basis with other people who were in a similar frame of mind as myself.
You mentioned before that you trained as a videographer and also as a therapist. And just to jump on the main topic of today's episode, which is around your role as a videographer during Osho's time. So how did that came about? Did Osho ask you to shoot videos, or it was just a spontaneous happening?
No, it was actually a funny story. In those days, you could submit personal questions via letter to Osho. And at that point in my life, I had a film company in London, and I was making a variety of films, but mainly in the commercial area and some music videos and some documentaries too. And it was going very well, but I was also training as a therapist, as I said to you. And so before I ended my first 2 month stay there, I knew that I was coming back to stay for good at that point. I'd taken sannyas and I knew that I wanted to come back. But I wanted to get some guidance from Osho. So I wrote to him and I said, look, beloved Bhagwan, I'm involved in these two things. On the one hand, I make films. And on the other hand, I'm training to be a therapist. Could you give me some guidance as the best course for me to take? And he sent a message back, which was something like, if you enjoy therapy, fine, but film will be very useful. So I took that as a message to leave the therapeutic training to one side and to focus on filmmaking. And so I returned to London for about 6 months and wound up my film business there, and then came back to Pune to stay. And from that moment until Osho left the ranch, I was with him the whole time.
I spoke to Subhuti in a previous episode, episode 5, about the role of media in the commune, and he said that Osho wanted a press office since the beginning of Pune One, which seemed a little bit bizarre for a spiritual master, but then quickly it became very clear why he did that. So what was the idea of allowing you and other people in the commune to make films and do videos?
I think it's quite simple, really. I mean, Osho was his focus was on getting his vision out to as many people as possible. So he used whatever avenues that he could in order to do that. And obviously, video was one powerful way that people could come into contact with him and his teaching.
Okay, fair enough. And to me personally, there is something quite significant in that, because many people, especially millennials and new generations, they see Osho on YouTube, there are thousands of videos and millions of views, and take it for granted. But just to put things into context, Osho is the first Buddha whose words are recorded and available without manipulation or interpretation. We can't say the same thing for Buddha, Jesus that you mentioned before, Mahavira, Krishna, and many, many others. So you play a big part in this. You contributed in recording the one of the greatest spiritual masters' work and words in its original form. So do you feel this way? Do you feel that you have contributed to making Osho's work available today for and future generations?
You know, Saram, I always took it in a different way. It was such a gift to, first of all, obviously filming him, you it meant that you were often quite physically close with him. And you were also, my job wasn't filming, but also making films. And so you got the chance to work with Osho's words and image, and to really try and express the different elements of his unique and huge vision. So for me, it was always a thrill and a tremendous pleasure and an inspiration to be able to be in that position where I could dive into the substance of his teaching and try and convey that to the best of my ability with the films that we put together from the raw recorded material. As far as recording the lectures went, there was not much editing in that. But of course, it was always a joy to film him, because, you know, very, very often he would suddenly, you know, lock into the camera lens, and he would just stare down the lens, and you were looking in the viewfinder behind. So it felt that you were having this very direct and powerful energetic moments or moments with him during filming, which was also beautiful.
Well, yeah, I think the style of filming Osho's talks is beautiful, and sometimes there are moments where your camera concentrates more on his hands and the movement of the hands. And I've heard people falling in love with Osho just because of that. I know people in Russia, for example, that they say that they came to Osho because they were impressed, or, you know, there was some mysterious happening just looking at the movement of Osho's hands without even understanding his words. So, you know, I just wanted to share that. And so you were the man behind the camera during Osho's talks. And what else in terms of production did you do? You mentioned some documentaries and movies. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I mean, I was not the only cameraman. I mean, when we started filming on a regular basis in Pune, there were a couple of us, maybe three people, who would rotate behind the camera. And there were always obviously as the people around Osho grew, so the video department grew, and the work that we did grew with that, and the actual size of the department grew accordingly. But my role, as I say, was, apart from filming him, was to also document the activities that were going on around him in Pune 1, in the ranch, and in Pune 2, and then to come up with ideas to create longer films that could be distributed and give people a broader vision of what was actually happening around him in the different places that he lived. So my work included both those things. It was essentially filming him, filming the activities, and particularly at the ranch, the growth of that experiment as it happened, and then making various films that went into particular aspects of what was happening around Osho in greater depth.
Okay, and did Osho guide you in any way, in the way, you know, you were kind of meant to do this work, or did you receive any instructions or guidance from Osho?
Very occasionally, he would say a few things, but essentially, I mean, my experience of Osho was, you know, he was in this space of trust, and I think that he very much trusted the people around him, and trusted their love, and trusted the work that they did for him. And occasionally he would maybe comment on aspects of a film or suggest things. And we would very often ask him for titles of the film. So, for instance, when we made The Manifesto, I had come up with this idea of combining footage from the commune with newsreel footage to contrast the vision of Osho with what was actually going on in the world. And so I asked him what we should call this proposed film, and he sent back this very long title, which was The Manifesto for a New Man and a New Humanity. So he would often give titles, but essentially he trusted us. He let us do what we felt was appropriate and, you know, was a beautiful thing to create around his vision and his work. And there was some There may have been some practical details that were communicated, but essentially I always felt that it was something that we just dived into and then showed him, and he always was very beautiful in his welcoming of our efforts.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear. So Osho was essentially really very trusting and welcoming to the work you produced. And so it's clear that Osho allowed videos to be taken quite liberally in the commune. And there is a famous video which is quite controversial, and I think it's part of Wild World Conscious, recorded during a therapy group where, you know, there are scenes of people naked, shouting, catharting, and all the rest. So I think it was a German videomaker who shot that particular video. Do you know anything more about that video?
I wasn't directly, I was in the ashram when the German filmmaker came and did the footage, but I was not directly involved with the filming of it because he had his own cameras and his own crew. But I was around the ashram when it was happening. I think one thing that was not clear in Wild Wild Country, that actually the people who participated in those therapy sections were hand-picked by Lakshmi, by one of her staff, too, because they were experienced in the various therapies that were being offered at the time. So it rather changes the whole way you look at it when you understand that these people had volunteered to participate in it and had been encouraged to allow as much expression as they could on the back of the experience that they'd had previously in the therapy groups that they'd done. I think the difficulty came was that, you know, no one really foresaw the impact of that footage in the particular context that it eventually came out just after we arrived in Oregon. And, of course, it was very shocking in that way to ordinary people and probably was not the best kind of publicity for us at that time. But I think it's important to realize that those people in those groups had all participated voluntarily, having been asked if they wanted to, and, you know, had given their all to try and show the level of intensity and exposure and depth of the inquiry that was going on in those groups. Now, it's very difficult to empathize with that unless you've actually participated in one of them. If you participate in one of those groups, you understand the amount of love that is actually that were in those rooms as people went into this deep trauma from their own psychological past, exposed it and healed it. But without actually having had that experience, and with just a few very dramatic clips taken out of context, of course the impact of it tends towards a much more crazy set of interpretation. But the truth of it was not that whatsoever.
Well, thank you for clarifying and giving us the context. In fact, I'm learning something new. I myself didn't know that was a video done somehow on purpose, if I hear you correctly. So my impression was that the German videomaker somehow was allowed to enter the commune and just go around and record whatever he could. And in that particular case, he entered a therapy group. So whereas what you're saying is that it was kind of done on purpose, so like the people knew that there was a filmmaker and they were kind of showcasing an example of what a therapy group looks like. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it's fair to say, as long as you understand that it wasn't faked, it wasn't staged in any way. The people who participated in it were handpicked because of their experience and their familiarity with that kind of intense therapy. But what actually went on in the chamber at that time was real. No one was faking it. But they, you know, those the therapy rooms where those groups used to happen were very confined spaces. And if you have a cameraman and a sound recordist and a director in there, you know, it's not something that you can sort of hide in any way, you know. So basically, in order for it to work properly, the thing had to be arranged. And that is how they did it, according to my understanding. But I want to emphasize that it wasn't fake in any way. It wasn't staged. It was simply using people who had had experience in order to try and give the clearest and most impactful account of an event that many people participated in when they came to Pune.
To me, it makes a lot of sense, and it's a pity that the context was taken away, and obviously that video put in a different context came as a shock to many. Do you know if Osho made any comments at all about that particular video?
Yeah, I didn't hear any feedback from Osho on that, but I think that, you know, I think Swaram, I mean, the other thing to understand is that we were very much in a unique and extremely out of the ordinary situation in going to India at that time and being with Osho and in involving ourselves in cutting edge therapy. I mean, these therapies around the world at that time, there were only very few places like Esalen in California and some places in London in England that were going into this kind of level of psychological work. And so we were really felt we were pushing new boundaries as to how we could approach the inner psychology that we came with and heal it and get rid of the blocks and the trauma that every human being almost inevitably picks up as they grow up and mature into adults. So I don't think that we were aware at that point of the gap between where we were and the lives we were living and the ordinary outside life. And I think we had to learn quickly that we needed to communicate in a way that wasn't so shocking for people. And I think that we did improve that over the years.
So let's move on and talk about something very special and precious. I understand that you filmed Osho's body shortly after he had left it. So can you tell us more about those moments and what happened then?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, that evening, Osho had been coming out to sit with us only intermittently during that period because he'd been experiencing some difficulty in his body. And I had been working actually on a film, on editing a film that day. And in the late afternoon, I had finished my work and I bumped into Ananda, and who was Osho's secretary in those days. And I said to her, is Osho coming out this evening? And she said, no, I don't think he's coming this evening. So I said, okay, great. And I went back home where I lived outside the ashram, and I was tired. So I decided that I would just enjoy the evening and the sunset where I lived. And suddenly there was a bit of a commotion outside of the house. And this guy I knew from the ashram ran in to my house and said, Matriba, you need to come to the ashram right away. Ananda needs to see you. And so I got in the car with this friend, and we didn't speak at all on the way to the ashram. And somehow, I don't think either of us knew at that point what had happened, but the urgency with which he'd come to me and obviously how it had been communicated to him, I think it was pretty clear that something dramatic had happened. Anyway, I came into the ashram and I was going up to the video department and I saw Ananda, and she said, Osho's just left the body, get the video equipment and come down to his room. So it was shocking to hear that. And I ran up the stairs to get the camera. I grabbed a friend of mine, because in those days there was a separate recording pack and a separate camera. and made my way down the stairs. And just as I exited Krishna House, which was where the video department was, the people who had been waiting for Osho in the hall were at that moment receiving the news from Devaraj Amrita, who was his personal doctor. And literally, as I came down the stairs onto the pathway, which backed onto the back of the hall, I heard this kind of collective cry of pain. It was, I'll never forget it. It was almost like thousands of people had just been punched in the gut as they heard the news that Osho had left the body. So that was a very strong experience as I made my way down the path and went into his room. And it was me and my friend who was carrying the recorder, and there was Osho lying on the bed and dressed in his immaculate robe and in very low light and lying completely still. And it was a very unusual experience for me to be so close to him and for him not to be looking at me or moving or talking. And as I started to film him, and as I went up close to film close-ups of his face, I suddenly had this thought of the Zen stories that Osho used to tell, like the one where the Zen master died, but he had particular instructions that his clothes should be packed in such a way. And then when they put him on the funeral pyre, suddenly all the fireworks that were hidden in his body started to explode. And there was this tremendous fireworks show. And I just remembered all these Zen stories of Zen masters playing tricks around their death or making their death into some sort of special and impactful event for their disciples. And as I went closer with the camera to his face, I was gripped by this terrifying thought that he was suddenly going to turn around, open his eyes, look down the camera lens and go, boo! And that would be the moment that I would transcend. Anyway, for better or worse, of course, it didn't happen, but it was a very, very powerful and silent and moving space to be in, and almost incomprehensible. The brain had not caught up with the fact that this man who you loved was actually no longer in the body, because to all intents and purposes, he just looked like he was meditating or asleep. He looked completely alive. And I've seen other dead bodies that really you know immediately that there's nothing left in that body whatsoever. But Osho looked completely alive. And when they came in to transport him to the hall, and I walked with the bier that he was lying on, and I always remember the incredible looseness in his neck as he just moved with the movement of the people carrying him. And it was just very difficult for the brain to accept that he was no longer in the body.
Well, they say apparently that when an enlightened master leaves the body is a very special moment. I would like to pick up on the fact that you said that Osho's body looked different compared to other dead bodies that we have seen, and almost looked alive. And he was so relaxed, and his neck would move with the movement of the people around. And I think that's a testimony of the fact that Osho was not exactly the same as, something happened to this man, for sure.
Yeah, it was, as I say, it was very noticeable. It was very hard, as I say, to believe that he was not still in the looked totally the same, and you know, in a beautiful, like, a he had a glow around him that I remember experiencing anyway. I as I say, compared with other experiences around dead bodies that I had, it was unique.
Okay, so let's jump to more recent days. I think I understand that you traveled to Tibet and walked around Mount Kailash, which many believe it to be the center of the world. And the purpose, if I understand correctly, was to make a documentary. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and what was your inspiration for a journey to Tibet?
Yeah, well, I went back to India. I left Pune in 91, and I was in Australia for a while. And then I went back to India in order to do some silent retreats up in the Himalayas in 96. And at some point, I decided that I wanted to stay up there. And I had to find some way of supporting myself while I was living in India. And I'd always wanted to go to the Himalayas because Osho had spoken so beautifully about them. And I, as soon as I got there, I loved them. And I had come across a book about Mount Kailash in one of my, I had a motorbike that I used to go up into Ladakh, which is part of the Tibetan Plateau, but in India. And I'd come across this book about Mount Kailash, and it had always attracted me, and I'd wanted to go there. And so I decided to take a group of friends there and also to make a film as we went there. And I went back. I went back three times in all to take people around the mountain, and it's a very strong experience.
Wow, and the movie is available, the documentary is out, and is there any way I can access it?
Unfortunately, the documentary itself is stillborn. We never managed to really create a satisfying film out of it, although we did work with, I was working with a couple of friends on it. So no, I'm afraid that's not available, but it's quite a special journey to go out to Kailash and walk around it. I mean, it's a 52, you walk around it. It's called a circumambulation, and it you started around 4,600 meters above sea level, and the highest point of the, they call it the Kora, and the highest point is at 5,600 meters, which is higher than Everest Base Camp. So it's actually quite a strong thing to do for the body, but it's also, as you pointed out, it's considered to be a holy place by three different religions of the world. And so it's got a lot of psychic energy attached to it. And you feel that when you go there.
Amazing. Well, definitely it's in my agenda now. One of the to-do list, in my to-do list.
It's worth it. I would recommend it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that. What are your current projects? What are you up to at the moment?
You know, Swaram, I live a very, very quiet and simple life here in Australia. I really am retired in every way. And I spend most of the time just by myself, three times a week. I live in a small cabin just outside Byron Bay, and three times a week I open up the cabin for morning silent sittings, and that's beautiful for whoever wants to come and sit. But otherwise, really, I really do very little, to be honest with you. My life is full of nothing.
Beautiful, full of nothing. And well, I'd love to hear how you transition to that, because, you know, I'm still, you know, working and now living in Singapore, and you know, I have this desire to retire quietly and live a much more remote existence. But I think perhaps I still have to complete some karma with the office, I guess. I don't know why.
Yeah, I think it's important. I mean, that was what was beautiful about Osho. He gave us this, you know, compressed, incredibly intense and varied and huge level of life experience when he was alive in the body and the commune was happening around him. And, you know, he always would say that it's important to, you know, complete whatever pulls you into the world of experience. And he gave us such an incredible jumping board to be able to fast forward our way through whatever desires we had left in our individual lives, and I feel very fortunate that I was in that kind of accelerator, that pressure cooker of life experience that really, it was absolutely unique and very rare too.
I like this idea of Osho, or living in the commune with Osho, as a life accelerator to burn faster all the karma and get out of the office.
Yeah. He used to speak about the role of the master as one of a catalyst, something that you know, just sped things up, that pushed things onto a different level. And if you accept that we all ended up in our bodies to go through whatever life experiences we wanted to, then in order to be able to do that and to live that to its full, the privilege of being around a master is really something unique and special.
Well, thank you so much, Mutribo. So we are heading towards the end of the episode, and I've got three final questions for you. The first one is, what's your morning routine? How does your morning look like in the first couple of hours of your day?
Okay, great. So I get up and I shower and brush my teeth, and then I have a public sitting in my cabin, or I sit by myself for 1 or 2 hours. So my day always starts like that, followed by a simple breakfast, and then the day generally unfolds in whatever way it wants to after that.
The second question is, what's your favorite meditation and why?
Yeah, I think I always followed what Osho said about it, and he always used to recommend Vipassana simply because he used to speak about it as a kind of a central distillation of all the different, I think, 108 techniques that are out there, and maybe more. So just the simple act of closing your eyes and watching your breath and staying present with that has always been my favorite way of sitting.
Okay, so the last question is, you lead the Osho experiment. You were one of the pioneers in this movement of creating a new man, Zorba the Buddha. What does it mean to you personally to be with Osho today in 2018?
I think, the event of Wild Wild Country was quite significant, I think, in terms of Osho and the dissemination of his vision and his teaching. I felt very, very grateful to the filmmakers because they actually managed to take news of Osho and his vision out to the widest audience that had ever heard of it before. And I think that maybe looked, right? Osho used to say that it was going to take 100 years before his vision would be fully understood. And, Wild Wild Country basically took place, say, 40 years into that time scale. And I think maybe it'll be looked back upon as a seminal event when, Osho's vision and his vision of a healthy and happy human being finally started to take root in a larger numbers of people. So I think that it'll be very interesting over these coming years to see what happens and what the reverberations are from that event. I think many people who saw that documentary series realized that what was missing was a deeper look into the lives of sannyasins. And obviously your podcast is one of the ways that is happening. So I think it's going to be interesting to see the effects and the deepening of that inquiry into Osho's vision and his teaching.
Well, and thank you so much for being part of the podcast and sharing your part of the story, because, that was one of the reasons that prompted me to start this podcast, to give voice to the people who were there. And, even though the documentary was trying to be as neutral as possible, but of course, there is so much more to that. So I'm very grateful that you and many other friends and sannyasin open and happy to share the stories, because I think it's very important to record your direct testimony of living with Osho, because you were the protagonist, you were there. And at the same time, I'm also positive, and I'm sure that World War Country is just the beginning, and it was so popular, it went so well, so I'm absolutely certain that there will be a continuation, there will be more investigations, more documentaries, more material will be produced and available for people who will get to know Osho because of that. And also just to reiterate that World War Country was possible because you were the guy who actually produced the raw material, the actual videos and the footages that was used. Most of it was videos, if I understand correctly, that you recorded at the time. Is that right?
Yeah, as I said, it wasn't just me. At the ranch, I worked particularly with one very good friend called Harp, and he and I were, I would say, the main videographers of the whole experiment at the ranch. And towards the end of it, there were other people who were also brought on board in terms of the filming, but in terms of the actual filmmaking, the films that we made, it essentially came down to myself and Harp.
That's great. And just out of curiosity, where all this material is stored? I mean, do you have any of this material with yourself, or it belongs to someone, or is in Pune with OIF, etc.?
It's a very good question, Swaram, and I've often wondered. There has been some pushback towards Wild Wild Country because they didn't give any credits for the filming that had been done by us over the years around Osho. And I think the foundation also were taking them to task about that. But I think the material that they used probably came from a film that Michael made called Rajneeshpuram, an experiment to provoke God. I'm not certain about this, but I think that he had got permission to use some of the footage that we'd shot over the years. And I think Wild Wild Country took that footage from his film. I can't say that for sure, but that's the feeling. As to the original material, I can only assume that it's somewhere stored by the foundation, hopefully safely and securely, but I really don't know where it is. I have heard that there are some individuals who managed to get hold of a complete library of it, but actually I don't know who they are, and I don't know if that's true.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Mutribo. That's the end of the show. It's been a real pleasure connecting with you, talking to you, and hearing your story and capturing your testimony. And it's so wonderful and beautiful for me. It gives me real joy to do this little contribution for Osho, his people, and especially for all the new people who don't know Osho and may have their life changed because of Osho. So thank you, Mutribo.
Thank you so much for having me, Swaram. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Love Osho podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, you can show your appreciation by leaving a review on iTunes. Visit loveosho.com for new episodes, blogs, and much more.